This whole period was an awakening time for women, the 60s, and there was a transition going on in the country. There was a sense of disquiet, a sense that women had been discriminated against. If you were a woman, you couldn't get a credit card in your own name. If you wanted to buy a car, you would ask, okay, where is your husband or your father? There was a sense of not having an independent life. So I got interested enough in the concept of what would you do if your life changed? If you wanted to go out instead of being just a housewife, just a mother, you wanted to do something.
Meet Phyllis Sinrich.
My name is Phyllis Sinrich. My maiden name was Phyllis Roisman. I was born in Brooklyn, was born on March 22nd, 1931.
Phyllis was not a marquee name of the women's movement of the 1960s and 70s. Those were people like Gloria Steinem or Betty Friedan or Bella Abzug. Those folks organized the protests and spoke to the media and became icons of what was referred to as women's liberation. The Phyllis Sinriches of the country were the ones that created the connective tissue between women speaking out for what they wanted and helping them get it. It's one thing to call out, life's unfair, even if it is, and it's another thing entirely to take it upon yourself to fix it. Like all women of her generation, Phyllis was raised on the idea that an American woman's highest calling was to cook a good meal and put on a pretty dress for when her man came home from work. Everything in our culture reinforced that message at the time. Yet Phyllis created programs to educate women that they could become accountants or doctors or lawyers or business people. And when these women couldn't get loans for their new pursuits, Phyllis built an institution to do that. Phyllis is emblematic of what I would call the hometown feminist heroes. They took the ideals being expressed by the women's movement and created the concrete steps required so those ideals could be realized. I'm Leslie Gold. This is a life's story. So tell me about your childhood, Phyllis.
1931 was still part of the Depression time. So life was very, in a way, restricted. We had a lot of family events, which were nice. We met frequently. We visited each other. And that was very pleasant. I can remember as a child loving going to the library. I used to go and hang out and wait until people returned their Nancy Drew books so I could get the next one on the list. And I recall that when we went to school, the boys would line up at one entrance and the girls would line up at another entrance. And that was the way school was run in those days. My best friend, who lived down the block from me, her father and aunt had ran a candy store, and we used to hang out after school and sit there. She was very thin, and her mom thought she really needed to be fattened up. So she would sit with a banana split in front of her, and I'd gain weight just looking at her. She didn't gain the weight. But it was fun. One of the most iconic memories was going to the 1939 World's Fair in New York. That opened up a world to us that we had not seen. It was the beginning of television.
Television, of course, wasn't in people's homes.
No.
Yet. This was a brand new invention.
Just the beginning. The amazing thing is that you could have a camera on you and then see yourself on the screen. And I was 8 years old, so that was a new world for me. My earliest memory of seeing TV was when I was married and had my own apartment. Now, I got married in 1952. Ford had an exhibit with colored automobiles, and you could get into one of the little automobiles and ride around on the ramp.
Before that, all automobiles were black?
Pretty much. For me, the yellow cars and red cars, those were mind-boggling. High school for me was another world of opportunities. I was very active. I took a journalism class, and I took art classes, and I ultimately became the editor of the high school newspaper. I had the most active, wonderful high school life.
Do you remember World War II?
Oh, absolutely.
And tell me, what were you doing during World War II?
There was extensive rationing, and the most precious thing you could get your hands on were the coupons that would get you milk and butter and meat, and if you had a car, gasoline. My mother was a smoker, and cigarettes were rare, and she used to roll her own cigarettes. But if you could get your hands on a pack of cigarettes, there was always this aluminum line, aluminum foil lining. And we were all asked to save the aluminum because they needed it to build airplanes. And we used to make a little aluminum balls. And when the balls got big enough, we'd bring them to a gentrified place where they collected balls, they collected rubber band balls. They collected everything that could possibly be turned into what was needed to fight the war.
Saving even the tiniest bits of aluminum foil was framed as your patriotic duty. Here's an excerpt from a movie piece presented by the U.S. War Production Board.
But without the scrap metal, which forms 50% of all ingot steel, the 250 million tons of steel which American mills have turned out in the last 3 years could never have been produced. Still to come is the final test, the test of continued steel making in the face of a dwindling supply of heavy industrial scrap. In Washington, D.C., no man is more aware of this danger than Donald Nelson, hardworking, dynamic chairman of the War Production Board.
Like so many other wartime jobs, scrap collection is not very glamorous or exciting. And often it is a little hard to see just what it has to do with beating Hitler. We must have a continuing flow of scrap in order to keep steel production at the level needed to meet our war requirements.
It is entirely different how fully engaged the country was in the war.
There were posters all over the place. Uncle Sam needs you. A slip of the lip sinks a ship. So you had to be very careful about what you spoke.
Wow.
And I remember in school, would watch the progress that the Allies were making as the war progressed. And I particularly remember when they landed in the southern part of Italy, we literally followed the tracks of the army as it moved up the boot. Italy is shaped like a boot. We're aware of what was happening. We were all engaged in so many ways.
Yeah.
And there was the blackouts. We had to keep the windows covered. There was a sense that the Germans might get to our country.
You were shielding your household lights so they wouldn't be able to tell where
right.
population
yeah.
centers were?
Yeah.
Is that, oh, wow. Did you go to college?
I did. I went to a Fashion Institute of Technology, which at the time that I went was not the amazing campus that it is now. I also was editor of the school newspaper.
Natch.
The writing was a very strong part of my life.
Phyllis found a way to put her writing skills to work within the garment industry.
And so I was writing about the fashion trends and what the colors were and what the styles were. By that time, I was married.
Tell me a little bit about how you met your husband and about your marriage and your children.
I met my husband when I was a young teenager through a cousin. There was not a whole lot of attraction on my part, but he kept calling me every night over the course of a couple of years. And the older we got, the more I found there were common interests.
Being that there wasn't that immediate attraction, when he did ask you to marry him, were you thrilled or were you thinking like, well, okay, it's kind of time, you know, we've been together a while? Or, I mean, do you remember how you felt at the moment? Or are you like, thank God someone wants to marry me?
I guess because I was very interested in what was going on in the world, we had a lot of, as I say, common interests. It was that we were, I think by then, comfortable with each other.
When did you have your children?
I had my children. My son was born in 1956, and my daughter was born in 1959. I think I was a pretty typical 50s housewife. I spent my time with the children and with the just running the household, being a wife and a mother.
Were you vacuuming in heels like Donna Reed?
I guess we always wore dresses and wore something with an apron over it, you know.
Mm-hmm. The overarching feeling about American women since the war was over was that they had it good. It was considered a woman's highest calling to keep a neat house, cook a good meal, and put on a pretty dress for when their man came home from slaving for his paycheck. The outlets used to reinforce this message were everywhere. School films, PSAs, movies, television, talk shows, they all told women how to act and how lucky they had it with their often unfulfilling, boring lives. When I went back to look for the messages that our culture was sending to women, I was surprised. It wasn't just the 40s and 50s. These messages persisted right into the 1970s. Here's just a few of the kind of messages women like Phyllis were exposed to every day of their lives from every corner. From a 1960s PSA.
Daughter has changed from school clothes to something more festive. Dressing a little makes her feel and consequently look more charming. Mother, too, changes from her daytime clothes. The women of this family seem to feel that they owe it to the men of the family to look relaxed, rested, and attractive at dinner time. Don't monopolize the conversation and go on without stopping. Nothing destroys the charm of a meal more quickly.
This is my favorite. Here's an ad for Folgers. The poor woman's world was shattered because her husband didn't like her coffee.
Harvey, want anything special for your birthday?
Just a decent cup of coffee.
You're kidding.
I'm serious. Honey, your coffee's undrinkable.
That's pretty harsh.
Well, so's your coffee. You know, the girls down at the office make better coffee on their hot plates. Well, see you later.
And he didn't even kiss me goodbye.
It seems utterly ridiculous now, but believe me when I say this ad and others just like it were everywhere and were delivered without a trace of irony or satire. Bad coffee meant a bad wife, and that was a label no woman wanted.
But when we moved up to Stanford, I joined the League of Women Voters, and I became very interested in what was going on in the world, what was going on in our country. And so I would take my daughter, who was then 2 years old or 3 years old, to meetings with me.
Phyllis's daughter, Irene Sinrich Sudak, is a former classmate of mine from the Harvard Business School.
And I do know that when she was early, I guess in her 20s, she heard Ayn Rand speak. I believe that may have influenced her desire for self-sufficiency, for independence, for living the fullest life that you can. And so I believe that has always driven who she is and the model she set for me.
And I can remember one day coming into the Irene's room, and she's there in my shoes with lipstick smeared on her mouth, and she had found my briefcase. And I said, "Where are you going?" And she said, "I'm going to a meeting."
Betty Friedan, who wrote the book The Feminine Mystique, is credited for identifying the problem that had no name. In 1962, Betty Friedan's book captured the frustration and even the despair of a generation of college-educated housewives who felt trapped and unfulfilled. Millions of American housewives were bored, unchallenged, unfulfilled, and not using their talents or realizing their potential. All while being told that having a shiny waxed floor and picking up the kids in a station wagon was the pinnacle of the perfect life. This book, more than any other, is credited with sparking the second wave of the feminist movement.
So that began my interest in women's issues and in the politics of what was going on in the country.
Was there a particular issue, particular women's issue at the time that really lit your fire, really made you angry, or you thought, above all else, this must change?
This whole period was an awakening time for women, the 60s, and there was a transition going on in the country. There was a sense of disquiet, a sense that women had been discriminated against. If you were a woman, you couldn't get a credit card in your own name. If you wanted to buy a car, you would ask, okay, where is your husband or your father? There was a sense of not having an independent life.
Amazingly, this requirement that women needed their fathers or their husbands to sign a loan for them, even if they earned more than their husbands, or even if they more than met the loan requirements on their own, this persisted well into the 1970s. It was another shocker for me at how long these practices lasted. Here's a news piece on the women's movement from the early 70s.
In 1970, America was still very much a man's world. More women than ever were joining the workforce, but at the same time, they were still expected to be the traditional housewives and mothers of a generation earlier. In some states, women could not obtain credit cards or mortgages without a male cosigner, and nationally, they were paid an average of 59 cents for every dollar a man earned. In short, American women were still second-class citizens.
Today, the National Woman's Party lobbies for the 26th Amendment to guarantee women equal rights under the law. That amendment would make women people in a legal sense for the first time.
Imagine an America where women had the right to vote but could be rejected for a job because of their gender. Imagine an America where women were refused admission to colleges and technical schools and denied access to credit cards. Imagine wanting to buy a house and being turned down for a mortgage because you're a woman. Imagine being a teacher and getting fired for being pregnant. This is what America was like right into the 1970s.
So I got interested enough in the concept of what would you do if your life changed, if you wanted to go out instead of being just a housewife, just a mother, you wanted to do something.
Daughter Irene.
What she observed was that there were barriers, and those barriers were artificial and needed to be removed. She broke barriers with abandon. She chose to take a difficult route to make life better for herself, for her daughter, for generations to come.
Hi, it's Leslie. I hope you are enjoying this episode of A Life's Story so far. We can do this for you. We'll produce a personal audio documentary for a beloved family member. We will capture their life story and present it in a beautiful piece of audio storytelling that you and your family will treasure for years to come. Details are at the very end of this episode. The women's movement created all sorts of subgroups and sub-organizations, all vying for headlines and coverage. Sometimes the issues these groups chose to highlight seemed trivial to outsiders and hurt the movement. They focused on protesting the Miss America pageant or burning their bras. By not staying focused on the big issues, it made it easier for opponents of the movement to belittle and mock it. Here's a group protesting a restaurant featuring a men's buffet night.
Women are persons. Women are people.
And we want to be able to come and go through it, and we don't want to be intimidated by signs that say men's buffet.
I have no intentions of taking this sign down or changing the sign. If you can get a court order to take it down, fine.
You have no intention of changing your policy of segregated facilities. Is that correct, sir?
If you women are that hard up for a glass of beer, I'll be glad to serve you at your bar.
In a way, the women's movement was naive. It was thought if they just pointed out all the injustices suffered by women, surely everyone would want to cure it.
I think, well, the main demand, of course, is equal rights. Equal rights to have a job, to have respect, to not be viewed as a piece of meat. Equal rights to set forth our own humanity. Equal rights to get into graduate programs, to get into schools, to training programs. We're the bottom third of the employment in terms of pay. We represent, nonetheless, 34% of the workforce, yet we're the first to be laid off and the last to be hired. There aren't frivolous demands at all. We just want what men have had all these years.
Phyllis started thinking about ways she could help, that she could make practical, concrete differences in women's lives.
University of Connecticut had a branch in Stamford, and I approached them with an idea for their continuing education program. And the idea was to introduce women to different types of careers that they might consider. And so I ran a class, and each session of the class, I'd invite an accountant. I'd invite different types of careers that they might find interesting. The concept being that they would develop a world that would be independent.
Okay, so if you're under a certain age, you're thinking, well, all right, that sounds like career counseling. It is hard to understand how radical this was at the time. The notion that a woman could, one, have a career, not a job, but a career, that was new. And that a woman should actually perform a job that a man was doing was controversial and radical at the time. Women were expected to put their home life first. And if they did work, it was in the typical female work ghettos of being a teacher or a nurse or doing secretarial work. And it was considered temporary until kids came along. A woman could get fired simply because she got married. Introducing women to careers in business and science, banking, or sales was a bold, forward-thinking endeavor.
These were women who had a lot of time on their hands. Their kids were in school. Their husband was working. And they felt that they didn't have their own place in the world.
It was probably all from the idea of men and women are equal, and there should be no distinction. There shouldn't be these artificial barriers, and that she had perhaps a degree of self-preservation, feeling worthy, always wanting to make a difference.
Then a new problem became evident to Phyllis.
I began to realize that women had very little knowledge of what the finances in their family were. They didn't have their own credit accounts. They didn't have their own bank accounts. They were dependent on the husband. In many cases, they had no idea of what the family finances were. Many instances of divorces where the husband would go off with some younger woman, and these women were left with no idea of how to run their own lives without the help of their husbands. This led my interest in forming a counseling program for women called Woman's Place. And we had social workers and others who volunteered to work with women who wanted to change their lives, who wanted to be able to adapt to what was happening to them, and that they know what steps to take.
As we are entering the mid-70s, the women's liberation movement seeped into every part of our culture. Everyone had an opinion, pro or con. I do remember that. In 1974, a former world champion tennis pro, Bobby Riggs, taunted Billie Jean King, the current top female player, into a Battle of the Sexes match. Now, Riggs was a top tennis pro from the 1940s, and he was also a huckster and a self-proclaimed misogynist. Bobby Riggs contended, publicly at least, that even a female tennis pro at the top of her game could never beat a male tennis pro at tennis, no matter his age. For Bobby, the match was one part competition, one part showbiz. For Billie Jean King, however, there was much more riding on it. She felt if she didn't win, it would set women back 50 years. Here is Bobby Riggs, pre-match, on with Johnny Carson.
She's carrying a banner for the women. Billie Jean King.
Do you like women? So a lot of people said you don't like women. This is really
well,
more
like
than
them.
Just...
I like them real good in the bedroom, the kitchen, and when they bring you the slippers and the pipe. And, you know, I really think...
You're a male chauvinist, fair.
I really think the best way to handle the women is to keep them pregnant and barefoot. This way, they don't worry about getting out in the men's world and competing for jobs and trying to get equal money and all that baloney. And they stay in their place and they help their men, and they're behind the throne, because I really believe, Giant.
You want them out plowing the fields, don't you, and just having kids.
The male is king, the male is supreme, and the women should know that.
Billie Jean King famously won that match. Chad Everett, a hunky actor, was a guest on the Dick Cavett Show about this time.
I have 3 horses and 3 dogs and a wife.
You want to think about the billing order there?
No. She's the most beautiful animal I own. Yeah.
Yes, the movement had reached critical mass of awareness, but not effectiveness. Phyllis felt it was time to amp up and help women get capital. Business loans, car loans, lines of credit. Most banks were still loath to do this, so Phyllis started a bank, the Connecticut Women's Bank.
I think the impetus at that time was there was a women's bank that was started, the first women's bank and trust company in Manhattan. There were a number of the, quote, feminist leaders at the time who were involved in organizing that bank.
Now, if I said to you, let's start a bank, likely neither one of us would have the vaguest idea of what to do. There are capital and regulatory requirements, legal requirements, background checks, applying for charters, the physical location, so much.
The amount of paperwork, the amount of follow-up that was needed was mind-boggling. You had to spend a year or more of your life putting it together, and we had to get a feasibility study which would determine if there was a need in a community for more banking, if there were the people who would be the board of directors would be qualified to maintain the bank. Could you raise the necessary capital that they would tell you? You needed to sell stock in the bank. All of this had to be determined. I think we had 10 women and one man, and he had some banking experience.
Ah.
And so this, step by step, we got the approval to go forward, and they wanted us to raise $4 million in selling stock. And this was we started in 1974. The $4 million was really... too much to ask of us. Most banks were required to raise $2 million.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Another obstacle.
But Right. Then we were able to raise the $2 million, and we opened in 1977.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big.
Yeah, I know. This song is corny and cliche, but at the time, it was a big deal, and it seemed to fit the moment. Things were beginning to change here and there for women. I think it is worthy of note that Ella Grasso was the first female governor to be elected in her own right, and that was 1974 in Connecticut, Phyllis's home state.
It was my job to do the publicity for the bank, to get out press releases, to develop ads to sell the stock. The best of all was somebody sent me a copy of an article from the Kuwait Times.
Ah.
We had made the front page of the Kuwait Times, which was, I thought, a very rewarding in its own way.
Besides it being called the Connecticut Women's Bank, what was the concept behind it?
This emanated somewhat from my experience with the UConn program. Here you are, you want to be on your own. Maybe you have an idea to run your own business. You would need to maybe borrow money to get yourself going. You could not get a loan as a woman in most banks. Most banks believed that women were not going to be a risky kind of
right,
loan.
They weren't credit worthy.
Right.
Your concept was different.
We would make credit available to women and men. We were not determined just to be for women. But we also ran a regular series of seminars and informational programs, educational programs, so that women would understand how to handle their finances and what they needed to do to be successful in whatever they wanted to do.
Did men come into the bank and just open run-of-the-mill checking accounts and things like that? Or was it like, ew, I don't want to be in the women's bank?
This is very interesting because we started out as the first women's bank and trust company. Then we did find that men were reluctant to have a checking account that said Connecticut Women's Bank. And so we finally turned ourselves into Connecticut Community Bank.
So the underlying mission was the same, but you had to change the marketing a little bit.
Exactly.
The structural changes were happening thanks to Phyllis and people like her who created the connective tissue between the hopes and dreams of the women's movement to the nuts and bolts of achieving those dreams. The culture was reflecting such change. Shows on TV showed women in new roles as working girls pursuing real careers, as crime fighters and superheroes. And then a sitcom about a loudmouth, unabashed feminist. And then came Maud.
Maud! I'm only here because of Edith. The fact that you happen to be here with her is beyond my control. Like any other freak of nature.
At that point, would you have considered yourself a full-fledged feminist?
I didn't think of myself in terms of being a feminist. I guess other people would call me a feminist. The term would be appropriate, but in some sense, there was a certain derogatory affiliation that people had, or some people had with it. I just felt that this was, that I was doing something to help change a situation where women were being discriminated against.
Irene Sinrich again.
She was always there, always available for me. But as soon as I was old enough to be more out of the house on my own, i.e. high school, where, you know, I'd be there for a full day, she was very quick to say, I want to create my own life separate from being the wife of Norman Sinrich, my father. And she really put herself on that path, you know, really sent a very positive message that you can be part of a family, but you can also follow your own path and make your own destiny.
Wow. And at that point, I had accumulated so much connection with media, radio and television, that I decided it was time for me to open my own business.
After 30 years, Phyllis and her husband divorced. and it was a brutal divorce.
That's a very painful, very painful memory. And so we were married 30 years. It was a very, very difficult divorce.
Who decided to get divorced?
I wanted to. What happened once it got underway was, it was just painful every step of the way. Being a lawyer, immediately went and interviewed every lawyer who might have been a lawyer for me. He went and interviewed them so that they were not available to me.
And I was actually the biggest fan of the divorce. They were miserable together. They were so unhappy together. So I have a very different view. By the time they officially got divorced, I was graduating from college. But the acrimony, you know, my dad's was a very interesting person. Could be charming as anything, but ruthless. He was aghast that she requested the divorce. Mm. And so he was spiteful.
He would not move out of the house. And we finally went to court, and the judge said we had to live in the same house together. And it was a nightmare.
Was he surprised by your decision to want to get a divorce?
No. I mean, by then we had been, you know, had a number of instances that were, that led up to my decision that I finally had to make a break.
Do you think because the end of her marriage was so brutal, that was the reason she never remarried?
Oh, no. No. My mom was having too much fun not having to do things for men. She had a few opportunities to remarry, and she said, I'm happy to be with them on weekends, but I'm an independent woman. I have my own interests. I don't want to have to suppress those because my spouse is telling me what I can and can't do.
At this point, Phyllis could really organize anything. So she chose to start a first night in her home city of Stamford, Connecticut. First night is an artistic and cultural celebration from afternoon until evening on New Year's Eve. It involves music, dance, comedy, art, fireworks. It involves hundreds of events done at scores of locations around a city. It is enormously complex. You have to source multiple venues and turn them over throughout the day multiple times. You need scores of entertainment acts, plus other activities, and often there's food offerings as well. And then there's the scheduling and logistics of all of the above, and the parking and the security. And you have a single day to get it right. It is not for the faint-hearted.
You need hundreds of volunteers. When you are starting a first night, it's a lot more than what you've described.
Mm.
First of all, you have to become a nonprofit organization.
Oh, see?
So,
I didn't know that.
Again, you've got to get a board of directors who have the skills to do the different things that you need. And we needed graphic artists who would create all of the visuals that we need. You needed to create a program so that people knew where things are and what time. You needed somebody to raise money to make it all happen because you have to pay some of the entertainment people.
Just to source all the kinds of acts and activities you need on that first year, right? As you go along, of course, you can, you know, if you use a magician, you can call him back the second year. But you have to find that magician the first year, the face painter, the rock artist, the folk singer, the dance troupes, or the stilt walkers, whatever else you have going on. Just sourcing all the entertainment is huge.
The way I got it done was I put up an enormous whiteboard in my office. On one side was the list of committees, the different committees that were doing different things. And across the top was the 12 months of the year. And I kept track of everything that way. The important thing was that neighbors would be walking down the street and see each other. They could bring their children. And it was a way of celebrating New Year's Eve without having to get drunk. I think of my life as a procession of chapters. I had my chapter when I was the 50s housewife and mother. I moved on in my life and did different things at different times.
A lot of girls, a lot of, you know, women my age, you know, would tell me what horrible relationships they had with their mom. I never had it with mine. She was my friend. I could talk to her about birth control. I could talk to her about anything. And she was always there for me, always supportive. I think she had had a troubled relationship with her own mother. And so she set out to have a different relationship with me. One with me that she would have wanted to have with her own mother and didn't.
I think getting older hopefully gives you a full life. And I feel like I have had a full life. I have filled my life with things that I've accomplished and that make me feel that I have contributed to the world in some ways, and I've contributed to myself.
When I reflect on Phyllis's life, I am reminded about how all our lives are enhanced by those that endeavor to take on problems, universal problems, and how those closest to the problem are often closest to the solution. When Phyllis saw obstacles, she looked for ways to remove them. When she saw opportunity, she took it. And there is a lesson about doing something, even something small. That'll beat doing nothing every time. Her first endeavor of counseling women on job opportunities seems quite modest, but it mattered. It led to solving another problem, teaching women about household finance, and then about business finances. In the not-so-modest category, Phyllis moved on to getting women capital to realize their pursuits and potential. Phyllis made a difference in the lives of other women by doing what she could, where she could. It is not an overstatement to say Phyllis helped create economic equity, which was crucial to the empowerment and independence of women. Phyllis helped create a world where daughters had the same opportunities as sons. I'm Leslie Gold. Thanks for listening to A Life's Story. Hi, it's Leslie. As I create these episodes, I can't help but think of my own parents. They're gone now, and I wish I did this with them. I'd give just about anything to hear them tell their stories in their own voices again. And I thought, well, that's a service worth providing. So now you can get the full life story treatment for your loved one. We capture the life story of an important person in your life, say your parent or grandparent, and create a beautiful piece of audio storytelling that they will love and that you will treasure. You'll be proud to share it with your family, one day your kids and your grandkids. And the personal audio pieces include all the bells and whistles you hear in the podcast episodes. We do in-depth interviews. We score with music, use historical sound. We build a story arc, provide professional narration, and add additional voices. These pieces come out beautifully. And speaking from personal experience, one day you'll be really glad you have it. We are creating personal love stories too. So go to alifesstory.net for more information. alifesstory.net. You can book a call with us from the site and we can discuss who you have in mind for a personal project in a totally no pressure call. alifesstory.net.